As we ran out of time last week, we were talking about first speech. And we'd just talked about the fact that Eliphaz was following a path, though much of what he said was true, he was still following a path that was going to get him into trouble ultimately. And that it was difficult for Job to answer what Eliphaz was saying, because while the principle was true, the premise, the beginning premise was true, the conclusion was not correct. And you can do that. All you have to do is be illogical. And you can have a premise that's correct and still reach an inadequate and incorrect conclusion. In the part of the chapter at which we're looking, and that is down verses 18 to 21 in chapter 4, Eliphaz is talking about the fact that there is a great difference between God and all of his creatures. It's an immense difference. And God is above all. He is above his servants, he's above his angels, he's above his holy ones. And still, according to what Eliphaz is saying here, God does not trust any of them. He is God, and he does what he does, and all of his heavenly beings, according to Eliphaz, give him no information. It is God who is working it. And then that leads Eliphaz to the question he really wants to ask, and that is, if God knows it all, and if God does it all, then Job, why do you think that he would then trust a man who lives in a house of clay? I mean, we are not God. We are not even close to God, Eliphaz is saying. And certainly that's the idea of these verses here from 19 to 21. And that has to do with the frailty of man. And that is certainly true. In fact, he suggests in these verses that the existence of man is so fragile that they're crushed, just like a moth. One thing Millie and I have learned since coming to Alabama is you don't go through a day without stomping a roach. It just isn't done. And that sort of is like man, because man is so fragile that that's all it takes to get rid of him. And the effect is dismal in the extreme. They perish without regarding it. They die without wisdom. Eliphaz apparently doesn't think too much of mankind's ability. But it is precisely God's great advantage over man that makes it seem to Job that the way God is treating him is unfair. God is so great that he doesn't need to put man down in order to protect himself. He could let man become anything man wants to be, and it doesn't bother God, because God doesn't need to put man down. He can let him go. And God is still number one. He is still the omnipotent. He's still the omnipresent. And he is going to get his will done. Now, the friends have done something that's very good here, in one sense, because Eliphaz has been talking about the incomprehensibility of God. If you understand, if we have anybody in the audience who understands everything about God, would you please raise your hand? I didn't think so. They were talking about how incomprehensible God is, and that is something that is certainly true. We know what God has revealed to us about himself. But what I'm suggesting is that God has revealed to us that which we need to know, and that which will help us to know. But the existence and the nature of God is so overwhelming to us that we cannot even begin to start to commence, I think, to fully understand the very nature of God. Now, Job understands fully that he is a creature. He is a man. He is not God. But where Eliphaz and Job apparently parked company is, that Job also thinks that he is a special creature. He is a creature that God has made. Notice the similarity between the word creature and create. God created him. And if God created Job, Job thinks that he is a very special creature, not just a mere creature, as Eliphaz was talking about man. And Job is not going to be silenced by reminders that it's not for puny man, this puny creature, to question the ways of God. Job is not afraid to question God, and he does question God. His questions may be unanswerable. His questions may be something that God will not answer. But as far as Job is concerned, he's going to ask them anyway. He takes the position, I think, that he has a right to ask these questions. His question, I think, does not arise from his unbelief. I would suggest that his questions arise from his belief, because he believes in God. He believes that he is a great God. He believes that he's a loving God. List all of the qualities of God. Job believes that. And what he does not understand is why then God will not answer his questions that he is asking. Now, we've suggested before that Job never gets answers to his questions. But he does hear from God. We'll get there toward the end of the book. He does hear from God, and he drops his questions, because Job is going to come to understand some things based upon how God does respond to him. Viewed in this light, Eliphaz's next word is a terrible blow to Job. Because what Eliphaz is suggesting as we get into the fifth chapter is that it's very futile for Job to cry out in prayer, because there is no one to answer him. Call now. Is there anyone who will answer you? And to which of the holy ones will you turn? For vexation slays the foolish man, and anger kills the simple. This is not a general statement about everybody, because Eliphaz himself has just claimed to be the recipient of a revelation. You'll recall that Eliphaz came out and said, "Hey, I've had this vision, and the Spirit talked to me." And then he said some things to Job as a result of that. But that's not a general statement that he made back here that includes himself, because he just had that experience. So this is a statement that is directed only at Job. Job, why don't you try praying? God's not going to talk to you. It's Job in the mind of Eliphaz who is disqualified. Eliphaz seems to have concluded that by his vexation and jealousy, Job has become a fool. Verse 2 of chapter 5. Job has despised the chastening of the Almighty. And that's down in verse 17 in this same chapter, chapter 5. As he cannot turn to God, Neither can he turn to one of the holy ones. The concept being that would be a go-between. And we have seen and we will find that Job calls for go-betweens. I want to present my case however it's done. And he has the concept of a go-between. It's significant to Job. Job sees the necessity of a mediator in this disagreement, if I may use that word, that he's having with God. But the only thing Job can do is to grope after the need that he recognizes, and that's the mediator. And if he could just get the mediator to come in and solve this matter between him and God, then suddenly his entire fortune is going to be reversed. The third verse in chapter 5, the last part B, suggests that the curse of a good man like Eliphaz can secure the downfall of the unworthy. Just let me take care of you and everything's going to be okay, Job. Well, Job would rather have a mediator than to have Eliphaz. Job has a difficulty here that you and I do not have. Because Job could not possibly at this point have guessed at the incredible solution that God was going to bring about so that there is a mediator between God and man. There is one God. And one God, one mediator between man and God, the man Christ Jesus. God did it. But Job was too early. And he just didn't have the possibility of seeing what you and I have seen and enjoyed what you and I enjoy in Jesus Christ. Later, Job's going to object to the doctrine that a man's sins are visited upon his children. That'll be way over in chapter 21 and verse 19. In verse 4, his sons are far from safety. They are even oppressed in the gate. Neither is there a deliverer. To talk about there is no deliverer is an expression that is used frequently, I think, in connection with those things that are caused by God, and he's the only one that can do it. He's the only one that can undo it, and there's no one that can deliver man from those things. But some texts, instead of the word gate there in verse 4, they are even oppressed in the gate, have the word tempest. There is nobody, his children are oppressed in the tempest. You remember how Job's kids died? A mighty wind. And those who think tempest is the right word to use in this place believe that Eliphaz is now playing dirty, and he's coming out and saying, Job, remember what happened to your kids. I expect Job had not forgotten what had happened to his children. The meaning of verse 5 is less clear. It could mean that the rich man is reduced to begging, but most translations give the impression of the ruin of his crops by pilferers. The man in Job's condition, his harvest, the hungry devour and take it to a place of thorns, and the schemer is eager for their wealth. People are after the money of the wealthy and after the crops of those who grow them. And Job was in that position. Verses 6 and 7. For affliction does not come from the dust, neither does the trouble sprout from the ground. For a man is born for trouble as sparks fly upward. These verses imply that a man's trouble is innate and inevitable. It is because we live in this world. And we are going to have some of it, no doubt. In verses 9 to 16, Job ascribes such experiences to God, or Eliphaz does. So, although a divine agent is not named in verses 3 to 7, he's probably insinuating that it is God. And that God is the hidden cause of the fool's trouble. Remember, he thought Job had become a fool, and that was part of his problem. The difficulties that Job had were so broadly spread that the problems might appear to be natural. But Eliphaz is not taking that line. This is something that is Job's, and it's happening to Job, and it's something that he cannot do anything about, just like you and I can do nothing about the sparks that fly upward from a fire. So far, Eliphaz's teaching has been rather gloomy. In verse 8, he tries to strike a more cheerful note. But as for me, I would seek God, and I would place my cause before God. Well, how long has Job been talking about that? I want to hear from God. I want God to answer my questions. I want God to tell me what is going on here. And Job has one thing. He's still trying. He's still going after it. And I think he's still optimistic that it will work. If there's one thing that ought to keep us from pessimism, I think it's faith. The invitation to pray in verse 8, I would place my cause before God, is a legal term. It's to seek God as a deliberate act, not just leaving his cause to God, but submitting it. I submit my case. I present my case. And that's what Job has asked for and will continue to ask for. Don't you think that Eliphaz's advice here is just a little silly? Because if Eliphaz has been listening, he would know that that is what Job has wanted more than anything else, and here he is advising him to do it. You know, we get into trouble a lot that way, don't we? We get into discussion with somebody and we never hear what they say because we're so busy trying to figure out what we're going to tell them with the knockout punch. And so we don't really have any feeling for what they're saying. And that's where Job, I think, and Eliphaz both are. Verses 9 to 16 is an ancient hymn, it's called. And it, even though it appears in Eliphaz's statement here to Job, it's really one of the most beautiful in the Bible. And also one of the clearest passages in Job. And the truth of the matter is, I think it needs no comment. And having said that, I will proceed to comment. But let's just read these verses 9 to 16 in chapter 5. Who does great and unsearchable things, wonders without number? He gives rain on the earth and sends water on the fields. So he sets on high those who are lowly, and those who mourn are lifted to safety. He frustrates the plotting of the shrewd so that their hands cannot attain success. He captures the wise by their own shrewdness, and the advice of the cunning is quickly thwarted. By day they meet with darkness and grope at noon as in the night, but he saves from the sword of their mouth and the poor from the hand of the mighty. So the helpless has hope, and unrighteousness must shut its mouth. That is a beautiful, beautiful passage. And there is something that we may not catch, but all of this is in the present tense. And that means that these are characteristics that are continual and will always be there. Among other things, it tells us that God has all power over nature, verses 9 and 10. He's supreme in the affairs of men, verses 11 to 15. Wrongs are redressed, injustice is silenced, verse 16. And in verse 17 through 26, we get the final poem in the speech of Eliphaz, and it speaks of the happiness of the man who takes the troubles of life in the right spirit. It also is a beautiful tribute to the fatherly care of God. It's strict, but kind. His apparent severity in sending sickness, verse 18, setbacks, verse 19, famine and war, verse 20, fire and flood, verse 21, plagues and wild beasts, verse 22, is more than outweighed by his goodness in sending remedies for all of those disasters. At least that's the way it will work out for a man who is not impatient of the chastening of the Almighty. Verse 17, when disaster hits the godly man, he recognizes this as part of God's training and so can rejoice in adversity. This is a new idea. It covers the case that was not included in the simplistic classification of verses in 11 to 16, where the wicked are confounded and the good are helped. But you know where Eliphaz went astray in all of this? Neither applies to Job. We've talked about these general principles that don't apply to everybody. And here Eliphaz is talking about the good people and what God does for them. And for the wicked, they become confounded. Well, neither of these applies to Job. At the present time, Job doesn't have much. He's still faithful. He's still a good man. But he, not the wicked, the good man is the one confounded here. And this good man who has been confounded by what is going on in his life has found no help. Eliphaz's words are okay. And I would think maybe even that over the years as Job lived and prospered and he's helped people and the poor were lifted up and those in need, whatever, were assisted, that Job may have used some of those same words. But troubles that come our way are tests, whatever the cause. The person who realizes this responds to them creatively. The rebellious only make more trouble for themselves by resentment. Verses 23 to 26, the pleasing sketch of a wise man's life is not free from troubles, but much better, very often transforming difficulties into nurture and blessedness. Verses 23 to 26, for you will be in league with the stones of the field, and the beasts of the field will be at peace with you. And you will know that your tent is secure, for you will visit your abode and fear no loss. You will know also that your descendants will be many, and your offspring is the grass of the earth. You will come to the grave in full vigor, like the stacking of grain in its season. Behold this, we have investigated it, thus it is. Hear it and know for yourself. Eliphaz has some good closing words. Eliphaz, I think, speaks for what we might call all the wisdom teachers, because here he uses a we, and that's plural, suggesting that he's not speaking just for himself. But Eliphaz is quite convinced that what he's saying is true. And now it's up to Job to give heed and experience it for himself. That's Eliphaz's position. Well, again, question, what is Eliphaz's defect? Why does God single out Eliphaz out of the three friends? And he singles him out at the end, and he says to him, "My anger flares up against you because what you say about me isn't correct." Chapter 42 and verse 7. Eliphaz's fault is not that his doctrine is all that unsound. Where he went most in the wrong direction is the fact that he was inept as a counselor. Isn't it the truth that thin words are mostly poor medicine for a man who's in the depths? And Eliphaz's statement, for the most part, as far as Job was concerned, were thin words. It's not a great deal of comfort, it seems to me, to offer Job health while he scratches himself on an ash heap, or to offer him wealth when the raiders have taken his positions, to promise him descendants while his children are lying beneath the stones. Tums are good for the tummy, but they don't do much for cancer. They were feeding him Tums, and he needed some very serious attention. His problem was that it was wrongly applied. Didn't apply to Job, and therefore it becomes useless. And if it is useless, then as far as Job is concerned, it is a lie. Eliphaz's basic assumption that Job is being corrected and disciplined sounds good. And more than that, it was the doctrine of the day. But it didn't apply to Job. Well, what was God's purpose in allowing all of this? Well, unfortunately, God didn't tell me. So I can't give you a "thus saith the Lord" answer. But if I had to guess, and I do, I would suggest that it is to honor Job and to glorify his faith. Because God knew there was no man like him upon the face of the earth. Job is about to take new strides into a new and deeper understanding of the God that he loves and that he's hurt because he's afraid he's lost, as we suggested last week, his relationship with God. By binding God to certain rules, Eliphaz has safeguarded his personal morality, but that's about it. His problem is that he brought God under obligation to a morality beyond his will, and that is a threat to God's sovereignty. God will determine what's right and what's wrong. He didn't need Eliphaz to advise him. And that's especially true when a man like Eliphaz thinks that he knows what that morality should be, and God, if you will listen, I'll let you in on the secret. I think very often we make mistakes in thinking about God in this area. Because if we wanted to make a rule for God, it would probably be something like, God must do good. He is good, He is loving, etc. Therefore, God must do good. No, not so. If God must do good, then good is higher than God. And God is not God. Because the Bible tells us there's nothing greater or higher than God. But what is the rule then? The rule is not God must do good. The rule is what God does is good. Period. Paragraph. What God does is good.
Well, it doesn't look that way to me.
Well, that's because you and I don't understand everything. But what God does is good. Job believes. Yes, ma'am. I don't think that Job, I haven't seen, and if I've seen, I don't remember, that Job had any indication that Satan was involved. Any comments? Somebody that knows that? Okay. No, I don't think so. I think Job just thought that he had been attacked by a number of different sources and that it had taken his life and living and family away, and he wanted to know what was going on. If Satan was involved, just occurs to me, he probably would have known what was going on. But he didn't. Job believes that God, as sovereign, may give and retrieve his gifts at his pleasure. Look at chapter 1. Verse 21. Job believes that God may send good or bad. Look at chapter 2 and verse 10. And God is not accountable to anybody for such actions. Eliphaz thinks he knows how to get along with a predictable, and that means to some extent, I think, a manageable God. Eliphaz has it figured out. Job has no such pretensions, and he faces the agony of getting along with God over whom he has absolutely no control. And he's trying to figure out that. Why is this, and what's causing it? He wants to present his case. The regular doctrine doesn't apply to him. Eliphaz's speech that promised everything would be all right if Job would just do this or that was perceived by Job as a deflection from his most urgent need, which was communication between him and God. And unless we understand that, we're not going to understand the vehemence of the outburst of Job in his next speech. Job tests the answers of man, and he rejects them. In the end, he's going to find satisfaction in what God Himself is going to tell him. The final restoration of Job, by which I mean the restoration of his wealth and his possessions and his family, is not in conflict with the conclusion that Eliphaz is wrong at this point. For one thing, the restoration of Job, keep this in your mind, comes after Job has settled everything with God. It's not a bribe. It's not the means by which God said, okay, I'm going to restore the friendship now. All of that was done after the relationship between Job and God was on the right foot again. Job's way back to this happy state is completely different from the route that was prescribed by Eliphaz. Chapter 6. Now, we've said a lot of bad things about Eliphaz, and I think a lot of true things. But to be generous with Eliphaz, let's assume that his chiding was gentle, not mocking, but Job was stung by it, as anybody I think would be. Job's response is a tremendous emotional outburst. He defends himself. He defends himself mightily against Eliphaz's insinuation that somewhere in his life there must be some fault, some big problem, Job, that needs correction. Job insists that his wild words are fully justified. Verses 2 to 7, in chapter 6. That he still wishes to die. Verses 8 to 10. His hope that his friends would refresh him has been disappointed, leaving him even more desperate. Verses 11 to 23. He challenges them to be straightforward in their accusations. Verses 24 to 30. Then he returns to the theme of man's miserable lot. Hope for relief requires more strength than any man has. Chapter 7, the only way out is death, and the sooner the better. Verses 1 to 10. Since this remedy lies solely in the hands of God, Job turns to God with greater passion. Chapter 7, verses 11 to 21. In his closing words, he looks into the abyss of doubt, which is the worst torture for the person who loves God. He must have some measure of understanding of God's ways to guard his mind against the thought that God is not fair. That phrase keeps coming up again and again and again. Now, with that background on chapter 6 and 7, let's look at chapter 6. Verses 2 and 3. Eliphaz is not in the least sobered by the reproof that Eliphaz put on Job. He has warned Job against the fatal consequences of bad temper. Chapter 5 and verse 2. Job not only admits that his words have been rash, he insists that his behavior is justified by the infinite weight of his vexation. Then Job answered, "Oh, that my vexation were actually weighed and laid in the balances together with my iniquity, for then it would be heavier than the sand of the seas. Therefore my words have been rash." Notice here that Job is talking about measuring all of the difficulties, troubles, disappointments, heartaches, etc. that he's had. You name it, he had it and had a double dose. And he says, I need it measured. I want to know. And he says, let me tell you what. If I had a scale and you put my misery on one side of that scale and you put the sands of the sea on the other side, my problems would match it. Job really felt depressed, brokenhearted, disappointed, all of the adjectives that you might want to use. In fact, it appears in verse 4 that Job is terrified. "For the arrows of the Almighty are within me. Their poison my spirit drinks. The terrors of God are arrayed against me." Job is terrified. The verse describes the armament of God, and he says that armament of God is set in battle against me. This is the first time that Job explicitly names God as the ultimate, if not the immediate, cause of his suffering. Here in chapter 6, first time he's complained about it, but first time he's named God as the ultimate source. Verses 5 and 6 have some rhetorical questions. You find them often in wisdom discourse to indicate absurd things, and that's what's done here. They often have a hidden meaning, and I think we find that here as well. Does the wild donkey bray over his grass? Or does the ox low over his fodder? Can something tasteless be eaten without salt? Or is there any taste in the white of an egg? My soul refuses to touch them. They are like loathsome food to me. The husbandman knows how to interpret the cries of his animals. And he knows when they're hungry, and he knows when they're mad and not hungry. He will listen to one. He won't listen to the one that says they're just annoyed. Job has a right, he's saying, I think, to bray like a hungry donkey and to bellow like a starving bull. The questions in verse 6 deride Eliphaz's speech as insipid. And you know that's the case because he says it's like tasteless food that can be nauseating if not seasoned. It needs a little salt. So, with that and the second bell, we will pause on chapter 6 and verse 7, where we will begin, Lord willing, next Wednesday night.